sure of that, just as he was certain that today Quandis had changed forever. He was living through turbulent times, and he hoped that such upset might provide enough confusion and distraction for him to do what he intended. Blinking away his tears, he went down and down. The staircase was long, and when he thought it ended, there was merely a wide landing area and another spiral shape inlaid in the floor. He followed this circular path, and a second staircase fell away beneath him. He thought of his sister, Daria, and wondered whether her violent death had been something of a blessing. She had not suffered many more years of abuse. She would not be alive through whatever was to come. Because the one thing Blaine was certain of as he descended toward mystery was that this was only the beginning. And while he was no godlike Kijtal, no savior, he might yet be the person the Bajuman had been waiting for. And if that was what they needed to believe in order to fight, perhaps he could give them that. Perhaps he could be the only Kijtal they required. He felt nowhere near ready, yet his time for standing still, learning and absorbing information had ended. It was time to act. The staircase ended in a small room with several tunnels leading away into darkness. He placed the blazing torch he'd lit up above in an alcove and picked up one of the more effective oil lamps stored there. He shook it and heard oil swishing around, glad that it was full. He had no wish to be trapped down there in total darkness. There was no telling what else might be there with him. He lit the lamp from the torch and took a few steps from the staircase. His surroundings were altogether more functional than the sea-glass-decorated room high above. Walls were smooth rock with a few carved sigils, faded and obscure. The floor was stone, polished over time by countless feet, inlaid here and there with curious arrow-shaped stones of different colors. He suspected they might be directional indicators, pointing to each of the several doors leading from the circular room. But he had no idea what each color or arrow meant. The air was heavy and still with the taint of undisturbed ages, as if the same air had persisted down here for eons. Somehow it was warm. That surprised Blaine, and troubled him also. It was as if something alive was heating the air with body heat. Or perhaps these rooms and tunnels were themselves alive, and he had entered the belly of the beast. A whisper sounded behind him. He spun around, crouched low, and wished he'd brought a weapon. There was nothing there. He breathed a sigh of relief, then realized what he'd heard. The whole spiraling staircase enclosure had risen into the ceiling, forming a flush surface that he could just touch on tiptoes. Trapped, he thought, and from higher up he heard a few soft thuds as the structure collected itself into its static form. He looked around in a panic, moving back and forth across where the staircase had come to rest, shoving shadows back with a lamp. Then he glanced at the floor and saw the same spiraling shape left behind. It was fainter than the one he'd first seen above, and carved into the stone rather than formed of colored sea glass. But he was sure it was a similar mechanism, and when the time came to walk it, the same effect would occur. He was deep beneath the Temple of Four, and the temple had sections that were almost 3,000 years old. Some of these subterranean spaces might be older still, and deeper. Perhaps there were even remnants of the first city. As he descended, he felt the weight of the hill and the deep history it carried above him, crushing down, and at the same time drawing on him with its unknowable gravity. What secrets might this place hide? What stories might be lost down here, forever drifting with no ears left to hear and no voices able to speak? He wondered if he was alone in this maze of rooms and tunnels. He hoped so. Then immediately upon that hope came to fear that it was so. If no one knew where he was, no one could help him if something went wrong. But what can go wrong, he thought. I'm used to being alone. It's where I need to be if I'm going to do this. Blaine chose an opening from the circular room at random and started walking. He entered a wide hallway that continued so far that the lamplight did not reach its end, and he was immediately comforted by signs of regular activity. Several hooks on the wall to his left held robes and belts, and a scattering of small alcoves contained the melted remains of candles. Farther along the hallway, an open doorway on his right revealed a dark room that grabbed his attention. At first glance, he thought it contained balls of thick snakes, a great mass rolling and churning in the faint light from his lamp. Then he gathered himself and moved closer to see a dozen coiled ropes hung from hooks on the wall. Nets filled with wooden pegs and mallets, and bags leaking powder slung from a rope line across the room. Blaine frowned. Climbing equipment. Down here. Confused and troubled, he moved on. The hallway curved to the left and down, and as it grew steeper, the flat floor turned into a series of wide steps. Channels on either side carried away moisture condensing and running down the walls. An occasional shadow skittered out of the light, and Blaine kept alert, wary of the ghast spiders he had heard lived in such places. He passed several more open doorways and peeked inside the rooms. A couple were sleeping quarters, cots neat and unused. One was a dining area, with a small table of neatly stacked crockery. One room was used for prayers, with several ornate rugs spread across the floor, and a symbol of the four cast into one wall, an elaborate design of sea glass, carved wood, and heavily layered paint. Blaine stood there for a while staring at the decorated wall. He wondered how many high-order priests came down here and knelt before this image, bearing their souls to imaginary gods. He had once secretly mocked them, all the time, as he also chided his own people for their continuing belief in Lemuria. How can our God be watching over us when we've been tortured, abused, and murdered as slaves for the past 30 decades? He had once asked his mother. Lemuria tests us in life so that we might triumph and sit by her side in death, she had replied. Well, fuck that. Since his teenaged years, Blaine had no wish to believe in a God who sought to put her followers through a life of constant pain. And if she did exist, he'd hate her. And yet he had seen the dregs of magic evident in Per Ristolo's eyes when he had commanded the phage. Only recently he had heard whispers among the novices of magic being harvested and absorbed by only those priests most ready to receive it. Old high-order priests, the most devout, and those wholly dedicated to the Four. Blaine had no choice but to believe in magic now. But still, he refused to believe it came from any god. He understood the contradiction, but he was a pragmatist. Like the seasons and the tides, perhaps magic needed no gods, but was simply some force as yet unexplained. Whatever it was, wherever it was, he had committed himself to finding it. Gods be damned. Soon he reached a large double doorway at the end of the winding corridor. Two heavy wooden doors filled the opening, braced with elaborately worked iron banding, the hinges the length of his forearm. A large split panel at the door junction held a keyhole on one side, and he didn't think for a minute that he would be able to get through. Yet if the High Order had something to hide, he wanted to see it. Blaine grabbed one of the door handles, turned it, and stood back as a series of metallic clunks and clangs echoed from within. Whatever process had begun took several seconds to end, and it finished with a heavy thud that he felt through the stone floor. Surprised, holding his breath, he held the handle again and pushed. One door swung open. From beyond came a waft of must, and a splash of shadow that seemed almost solid, washing the lamplight back as if extinguishing the flame with its coolness. Blaine took a couple of steps back and gathered himself before stepping into the open doorway. At first, the room beyond looked empty. Square, 15 steps to each side. It was merely 4 walls and nothing else. No furniture, no adornments, nothing to suggest why it was hidden behind such heavy doors. Such heavy, unlocked doors, he thought. The High Order must have been so confident of the secrecy of this place that they did not deem it necessary to use locks. As he stepped into the room, he noticed something strange. The far wall had a deep shadow at either side and across the top. It was only as he moved closer that he saw the shadows were openings. It was a false wall, hiding something beyond. Blaine had lost track of time. He might have been away from the others for 2 hours or six. There was no way of telling. There was also no way of knowing what was happening far above. Per Santiger and the others might be looking for him even now. Or they might be dead. I'm here, he thought. No turning back. Not until I've found something, anything, that might make this forbidden journey worthwhile. He skirted around the end of the wall, holding the lamp out before him, so that the space beyond was illuminated. It looked just like the other half of the room, except there was no door. Nothing particular set it apart. He aimed the light around, turning slowly, and then lifted it toward the freestanding wall that split the room in two. He gasped. At first he only recognized one small panel, a page from the Covenant of the Four known as the Promise in Red, a recitation that everyone was required to read aloud on their birthday each year. It was accompanied with images of the Four as pillars set at the corners of the world, holding up the full weight of existence. The Promise in Red was meant to provide strength to those pillars. As he moved the lamp back and forth, its light seemed to spread, and he realized that this was much, much more than just a simple wall. This was the fabled Wall of the Four, upon which those ancient gods had supposedly carved their own covenant with the future inhabitants of Quandis. He frowned and stepped back so that the light would reveal more. There were parts missing. He had seen many bound copies of the Covenant, and each tile here equated to one page from the book. Every copy of the book contained 11 blank pages, each one representing one of the lost 11 passages from the Covenant supposedly hidden or stolen away over the millennia. On the wall were 11 blank spaces where tiles had been removed. Disbelief vied with something else in Blaine's mind. He wanted to scoff at the folly of this place, buried so deep, and in worship of false gods, the effort of people to excavate and build this room, construct the wall, and carve the tiles was immense. Yet there was something about the wall that unsettled him, an otherness in the way the carvings cast shadows, repelled light, as if they were existing only halfway in this world. It was like looking at something made by no man. Perhaps his senses were so heightened that he was imagining things. Foolish fantasies, he thought, and he berated himself for being so twitchy. He wondered where the Lost 11 were. If anywhere, surely they would be down here, if they even existed at all. Much had been written about what those Lost 11 pages might contain. Blaine believed none of it, because he had always assumed that the Covenant was something written down by humans, not gods. The words and images seemed to shift and flow before him, like a viper hypnotizing a rodent, taunting his disbelief. The oil lamp sputtered, faded, flared again. Blaine held his breath. The wall had receded from view, and just for a moment he felt its weight before him. Solid, dark. When the lamp brightened, it was almost the same as it had been before. He squeezed past the wall standing in the middle of the room, exited the door, and swung it shut behind him. The lamp spat again. He swilled it and heard plenty of oil still in its reservoir. Perhaps the air was growing thinner. That might have been why his mind was playing tricks on him. He felt a heavy presence behind him, and when he turned quickly and aimed the light back into the shadows, it remained behind him, just out of sight over his shoulder, whichever way he turned. Footsteps followed his own. He paused, and the echoes went on just a little too long. Walking quickly, then running, Blaine took a series of turns. He only realized he was lost when he came to a junction he hadn't seen before, with three tunnels heading away from his central core. Colored arrows were set in the floor here, too, although he could not even recall which color arrow he'd followed the first time. Something thudded in the tunnel behind him. Perhaps it was his heart pumping blood through his ears, but whatever the message, he listened, turning left and fleeing the junction before his fear could catch up. "This is foolish," he thought, skidding around a corner. "I'm running from myself." However much he knew that to be true, calmness eluded him. He had no idea how extensive this underground warren was, and the more he ran, the more likely it was he would become truly lost. The High Order believers might encounter him down here in days, curled in a dark corner with his lamp long since extinguished, drooling and shivering and unable to shed the shadows no matter how much light the priests shone upon him. Or they would find him in many days' time, dead and cold, withered, life fled forever into the deepest night. Slowing, grasping hold of sanity and striving to give himself the peace and sense he required to find his way out, he fell. As he rolled, he somehow kept hold of the lamp and prevented it from breaking. Light and shadow danced as sharp edges bit into his shins, back, shoulders. He hit the ground hard, and looking back and up, he saw the old staircase he'd just tumbled down. Very old. The steps were dipped and worn from countless feet and endless years, and behind him, deeper, darker shadows drew him with terrible gravity. There was a stillness all around him now, as if whatever imaginary danger he had been running from had brought him here on purpose. This felt like a much older place than those above, and less frequented. Dust layered the floor, unmarked by feet. Spider webs blurred sharp corners. Long, thin stalactites hung from the ceiling. Stretching away from him was a tunnel formed in the solid rock of the land. This was no finished structure, but rather a cavern, a crack through the world that might have been here even before humans first appeared on Quandis, before the first city. And something was down there. No longer behind him, but beyond, pulling at him. A great power lured him on, like a moth to a flame, except this flame was night, this moth a man. It was a promise of something unknown, but he also sensed a startling intelligence, a dreaming presence that exuded the whole world as its dream dregs. It was humbling and belittling, and the sheer weight of that unseen thing threatened to crush the breath from his lungs. Finally, he thought, all the mystery of Quandis, all the magic that's talked about and dreamed about in the land, it's down there. And it's calling me. Blaine stood, wincing, holding bruises and cuts but ignoring the pain, because beyond the reach of the light in that deep tunnel, something was moving. He held his breath. The fear was different this time, more solid and tactile, because he knew this was not his imagination. This was real. The skittering, crawling things were coming toward him from deep darkness, lamplight glittering in countless blind eyes. Ghast spiders. He counted 10, but there might have been twice that many. Each one was as big as his fist, and any one of them could have killed him with its venom 100 times over. They were not rushing. Perhaps they knew that their victim had no hope. Blaine turned and ran back up the staircase, slipping, almost smashing the lamp, rising and running again. He dashed through corridors and hallways, crossed junctions without pause, constantly terrified that the spiders would catch him or his light would go out, or perhaps both. When he collapsed at last into a gasping, sweating heap, struggling against the sobs that threatened to rack his body, he pressed his face to the floor and felt a ridge cutting into his cheek. Lifting himself up, he saw a familiar spiral design. Blaine laughed, until he could no longer hold back his tears. Chapter 9. Queen Phila stood atop the blood spire, the wind rushing around her, robe whipping at her legs. The crown felt strangely light, but she had no fear of it flying off. The girl she'd chosen as her chambermaid had woven it into her hair. It was so strange to gaze out across Qandis, at the stripe of blue ocean in the distance, and to know all this was now her domain. So strange to think that Phila the Whisperer would find it much more difficult to come and go unnoticed, to vanish into the walls, or anywhere at all. And yet she was queen now, which meant that no doors would ever be closed to her again. Her mother had loved the blood spire, and Phila had always hated it. But now she understood the power of standing here and gazing out at a land that was hers to command. Phila? The newly crowned queen laughed softly and shook her head. You're going to have to get used to calling me, Majesty. Yes, I'm sorry. Queen Phila turned to study her younger sister. We're alone, Mirren. I don't mean now, although getting into the habit would be wise. You're still my sister, and I don't expect you to use the honorifics when it's just the two of us, but in front of others. Yes, yes, Mirren said, unable to hide her urgency. What of Deimos? Queen Phila asked. Deimos and his demand? It isn't a demand. He has a plan, a way to help, but he can't manage it if all the Bajuman slaves are... Queen Phila held up a hand, eyes narrowed. Something had shifted in the shadows against the spire. A moment later, the door swung open, and Daphna the Voice showed herself. Your Majesty, Daphna said, tucking a lock of hair behind her ear as she bowed. What is it? I gave instructions that my sister and I not be interrupted. The bony, hawkish little woman nodded. Yes, Majesty. And I'll retreat if you prefer, but I thought you would like to know that representatives from each of the 5 great clans have arrived together, presenting a single envoy. They wish to offer their condolences, and they are requesting an immediate audience. Phila arched an eyebrow. Are they really? Only hours as queen and already so many are making demands. She glanced at Mirren. Perhaps they need to be reminded what it means to be queen. Daphna the Voice stood rigid, awaiting instruction. Phila wondered how much she had overheard. Go on then, she said. Take them into the audience chamber and tell them I will hear their entreaties shortly. And Daphna, Majesty, if I ever suspect you are listening to conversations not meant for your ears, I will have the Silent carve those ears from your head. Daphna flushed, nodding and mumbling as she retreated and closed the door behind her. Come, Queen Phila said, taking Princess Mirren by the hand and following the voice. We'll discuss Deimos more soon. For now, let's see what surprises the day has in store. Each of the 5 great clans had indeed sent a representative. Her Ristolo was also there to represent the faith, and Phila marveled that the shuffling old man had the energy to make the trip across the city from the Temple of 4. She sat on the high seat in the audience chamber, struggling not to feel that the throne still belonged to her dead mother. Down inside her soul, a thin stream of grief trickled. Not guilt, but certainly a sadness. Phila had loved her mother once, had believed her to be strong and courageous and just. And now she told herself that Queen Lysandra had once been all those things. But time, Spiza, and a taste of forbidden magic had destroyed her and endangered Qandis. Phila had acted to preserve the kingdom and save the memory of the woman her mother had been. In her heart, Phila was emphatic on this topic. But down beneath the thin skein of grief, there existed a deeper stream. a ripple of suspicion that her mother had never been that woman, had never earned the admiration of her children, and that she had deserved the ugly ending that had come to her. Majesty, the envoy from Clan Hartshorn said, clearing his throat. Fury reddened his cheeks, and Fila could see the tremor of anger on every face. Searching for Aris, the city guard had invaded all their homes. That insult and intrusion had been enough to enrage the noble clans, and it had only grown worse from there. Queen Lysandra had ordered that search, and none of them knew what the new queen might do. On behalf of my lord and master, Baron Hartshorn, official historian of the crown, the envoy went on, I must join my voice to those of these others. We mourn the loss of Queen Lysandra, and offer our profound condolences. But in the same breath, we must object to her final edict. By our estimate, at least 700 Bajuman slaves have been executed by the city guard in less than a day, and this extermination shows no signs of slowing. Our beloved capital city of Lartha cannot withstand the economic devastation that would be visited upon us should this edict be fully enforced. The heart of Quandis is dependent upon the blessings of the four and the successes of the five great clans. In turn, the clans and the crown depend upon the faithful and diligent work of our slaves, and the Bajuman are a large part of that workforce. The Hartshorn envoy tugged nervously at his graying beard. His brows were thick and bristly, his eyes damp, his formal attire ill-fitting, as if he had aged and thickened in the months or years since he had last had occasion to dress for an audience with the queen. Clan Hartshorn beseeches you, Queen Fila.
Enough,
Fila said quietly, rigid in the high seat, taking in the entire gathering in a single sweeping gaze. You've each had an opportunity to beseech me. Calistrat and Docklin, Elster and Burnwell, Hartshorn, and the venerable Per Ristolo. That you come to me so swiftly after my mother's passing, and with so little sincerity in your purported grief.
Majesty, this is madness,
Per Ristolo said, practically choking on his feigned horror at her implication.
So many have been killed. I've even heard talk that two patrols of City Guard have gone missing. This must.
Queen Fila waved him to silence. She glanced at Mirren, who sat in the right-hand seat, elevated above the floor but not quite so high as the queen. The edges of Fila's mouth barely twitched, but Mirren had watched and mimicked her throughout their girlhood together, and she would recognize the smile there. A silent communication passed between the sisters. Daphna stood by the doors observing, visible to all but still as a statue unless she was required to speak as the voice of the crown. Now she cleared her throat. The queen is never to be interrupted, she said, without looking at anyone in particular. Fila wanted to tell Daphna she could speak for herself, but she might need the woman later, and had admonished her once already today. And the voice was effective. The six before her had been silenced with that simple phrase. So instead of chastising Daphna, Fila spread her hands apart, palms up, as if presenting her own beseechment to these envoys.
Surely your barons must not be as fearful as you suggest, or they would have come to this chamber themselves rather than sending you. They would have come to give their condolences personally, and to beg my indulgence, and to tell me, as you seem to be telling me, that Queen Lysandra's great will and wisdom are called into question by the noble clans of Quandis.
She let her words hang a moment, quite on purpose, but none dared to speak for several seconds for fear of making Per Ristolo's mistake.
Well?
She asked, privately delighting in the confusion the voice's command was having on this group.
Majesty, if I may,
the Calistrat envoy said, her head bowed low.
Clan Calistrat is already in disarray following the loss of our Baron and his family. No one doubts the wisdom of the late queen in naming the Bajamin as abominations and traitors to the crown. But were she still with us, is it not possible that with the concerns we have voiced, we might have prevailed upon Queen Lysandra to alter her edict? A flutter of pleasure warmed Phila's heart. These nobles were doing her work for her. The late queen promised to make restitution to the clans for the loss of their slaves, Phila said. Though I am told there are more than 11,000 Bajamin on the main island, and I will allow that had my mother been aware of that number, she might never have made such a promise. It took a moment for the anxiety to strike, and then all the envoys paled, even Daphna, already so on edge with her unpredictable monarch, looked stricken at this suggestion that the Bajamin might be executed without compensation. Such an act would ruin the noble clans, and surely result in open revolt among them. Queen Phila leaned forward on the high seat, regarding the aging Calistrate woman. If you could have made such an entreaty, what alternative would you have suggested? The Calistrate envoy glanced round at the others, who only stared back with urgent, hopeful eyes. The new queen had given her an opening.
Perhaps those clans who have holdings away from the main island, who have slaves working abroad, might be given time to call those slaves home, and their Bajamin slaves sent to the islands of the ring to work.
This time Phila did not dare to look at her sister, for fear that she might grin and give herself away.
Interesting, she said. Are you suggesting banishment instead of execution?
The woman had not truly suggested this, but now her eyes lit up as she realized it might be the perfect solution. The others seemed to be uneasy. For Clan Burnwell and Clan Docklin, this would be an excellent solution, as they had many interests and holdings along the ring. For Clan Calistrate it would be difficult, as their slaves would have to be retrained. But they had enough fishing interests that it might work. Phila could see that the envoys from Clan Elster and Clan Hartshorn were displeased.
Banishment, the Calistrate envoy said. If the clans had 20 days or so to make the transition,
the Hartshorn envoy cleared his throat and gave the Calistrate a meaningful glance.
But what of those who don't have enough slaves on the ring and beyond to replace the Bajamin?
The woman continued.
We could simply continue to execute them, the queen said. The Bajamin cannot be trusted. My mother always believed them to be abominations. But worse, the crown now knows that the Bajamin conspire against our rule and against our faith in the Four. Their blasphemous insistence upon praying to their one true God and the myth they continue to spread about their ancestors being the first people of Quandis. These things have been allowed to stand long enough.
She let the words hang in the air. After a moment, she glanced again at Princess Mirren. When she surveyed the gathered envoys again, there seemed to be a quiet consensus among them.
Majesty, if I may, asked the envoy from Clan Docklin.
By all means.
The Docklin representative turned to the others, ignoring Per Ristolo entirely.
It may be that my baron and the others with many outer ring holdings would consider taking Bajamin slaves in exchange for some of our own non-Bajamin from the outer ring. If we didn't have sufficient numbers, then the crown might offer restitution, as per the late queen's promise.
Queen Phila remained silent until absolute silence reigned in the chamber. The envoys barely breathed. Daphna did not shift an inch from her post by the door. All eyes were upon Phila, and she tilted her head and knitted her brow in feigned deliberation.
My first decree as queen, she said thoughtfully. I do believe that had my mother lived to hear these entreaties, in her wisdom she would have agreed. In the name and memory of Queen Lysandra, it shall be done.
In 20 days' time, all Bajuman must be gone from the main island. Any who remain upon that date will be executed without further delay. Your barons must work the details of these transactions among themselves. If there is any disagreement, any conflict among your houses regarding this edict, it shall be withdrawn and the original execution order reinstated. The crown has spoken.
Almost as a single voice, the 5 envoys from the noble clans bowed their heads and spoke a single word of assent. Majesty. Per Ristolo's features had turned dark and thunderous. Queen Fila, your wisdom rivals that of your mother, it is clear. But I must remind you that Bajuman who joined the priesthood are no longer Bajuman at all. They pray to the 4 and give themselves over to the gods completely. Surely, you do not mean to...
Fila stood, towering above them from the platform before the high seat. She glared down at him, letting the old priest see the bitterness in her heart. The High Order had indulged her mother's dangerous whims, had let her taste the magics that had killed her, had let her madness grow unchecked. She could not say any of those things aloud, but she would not be lectured by a priest.
Do not presume to tell me what I mean, Per Ristolo.
The old priest bowed his head, the storm of anger still etched on his features.
Majesty, he said.
I will consider your plea, Per Ristolo, Queen Fila said.
That is all we can ask, Majesty.
Yes, it is.
Per Ristolo glanced up, blinking in surprise at the venom in her voice, perhaps confused by it as well. It was clear the audience had ended, and Daphna the Voice opened the doors for the envoys to file out past the members of the city guard, who stood sentry in the corridor. When they had all gone, and Daphna had followed them and closed the doors behind her, Fila and Mirin came down from the seats. Mirin bowed to her, and then stepped closer and kissed her cheek.
Tell your love that I have given him what he wanted, Queen Fila said, and that the crown expects him to do as he's been bidden.
Thank you, Majesty, Mirin said.
Thank you, sister. You are even cleverer than I knew.
Fila did not advise Mirin to remember the lesson. She suspected her sister would keep it in her mind eternally, because Mirin was also cleverer than anyone knew, and that was a lesson Fila would keep from today. Because although she loved her sister, she would also keep a close watch over her. A very close watch. Chapter 10
Queen Fila had never truly desired many of the trappings that being queen entailed. Fine clothing, the best food and wine, superlative medical and physical care, servants and slaves. All these were pleasant enough. She would enjoy the food, care, and attention, but they were nothing to do with why she was here. More troubling to her, even now on only her 2nd morning as queen, were the traditions and routines of royalty. She'd had a good taste of this all her life, from almost before she could walk up until the moment her mother's death had been announced. There were scrolls and books aplenty about how royals should conduct themselves, and also whole histories about the duties required of royals, dependent on their gender, placement in the family, and age. There had always been some leeway and movement in these traditions, but there was still much expected of a member of the royal family, and someone with the blood of the 4 running through her veins. For someone with so many servants addressing her every need, and as many slaves as she required, as queen there was a risk that she would become more trapped than ever before by the constraints of a royal existence. A life with every moment and choice dictated was no life for her. It never had been. And Fila had always intended that upon becoming queen, she would announce a new deviation from the norm. A new royalty.
Yet that was easier thought than done, and she was already feeling constrained. The whole rigmarole of her mother's forthcoming grand state funeral was bearing on her mind, and while Daphna and other attendants busied themselves with arrangements, Fila found herself dreading the day. She would have to be at the forefront of events, presenting a strong, solid face to the many thousands of attendees. In such tumultuous times as these, there was nothing she wanted less. As well as the funeral, she would soon be moving into her mother's chambers. She had ordered all furnishings and adornments to those rooms at the heart of the palace to be replaced, and she was already planning some other amendments to the room structures that she would order the Silent to carry out. Shom and her soldiers were not servants or builders, but they would say nothing about the work they performed for their queen. Fila would never be able to relax in her mother's old chambers, knowing of the several spying places from where she had once watched. She would not allow herself to imagine strange eyes and ears beyond the walls, watching and listening to her own plans and schemes. Prior to the move and the funeral, Fila's plans to touch and explore magic drove her on. She'd had the briefest of tastes, and now she wanted more. She understood how effective magic could be in helping her make Quandis the great state it deserved to be. Yet she had seen her mother's rapid demise, and she understood something of its power, and the dangers inherent in experiencing its touch. Her desires were clear, but she would have to be careful and methodical in achieving them. Before opening her door to the inevitable guards outside and the many people in the palace beyond, she took a moment to herself, facing the future, contemplating all that her imminent actions might summon, and how she would change. This was what she had always wanted. She opened the door onto the rest of her life.
"Majesty," Per Ostvik said. Fila heard the surprise in his voice, but she heard something else there, too. Doubt, perhaps even suspicion. Not the reverence he should be showing to his new queen.
"Good morning, Per Ostvik," she said, stepping into the arched stone room. They were low down in the Tower of Batika, in one of the many small temple chambers that honeycombed the Temple of Four.
"I'm honored," Per Ostvik said.
He stood from the kneeling position he'd been in, both hands on his knees, groaning slightly at the discomfort. With his shaven head and heavy build, it was easy to forget that this old soldier was advanced in years. Not as old as Per Rostolo, of course. No one was that old. As the priest stood, he glanced behind Fila, clearly looking for the usual retinue of helpers and advisors, who usually accompanied the queen on her business. Of course, he saw no one.
"I'm here for a private matter," Fila said. "Actually, I'd like you to accompany me somewhere. We're meeting two other priests."
"A private matter," Per Ostvik said, his voice chilly.
"Something important to me," she said, offering a smile.
She tried to inject it with warmth, but it was difficult. "It was important to my mother also."
"Ah," Per Ostvik said. "And where are we going?"
"Deeper," she said. "We can walk together."
Behind her, she sensed a shadowy movement, and she knew that Per Ostvik saw it. His eyes widened, and she almost smiled.
"I'm not going anywhere completely alone."
Shom accompanied her, silent and forbidding. If she breathed, Fila could not hear it. Sometimes she wondered whether the Silent did even that.
"Deeper," Per Ostvik said, nodding. "And I assume the other priests we're meeting are of the High Order?"
"You assume correctly," Fila said.
"And Apex Euphraxia will be present also, of course."
The priest glanced aside as he said this, gathering his robes and bending to pull on his soft leather shoes, testing her.
"She will not," Fila replied.
Per Ostvik did not pause, but his shoulders seemed to slump, as if something he had feared had come to pass.
Your mother was not ready, and neither are you, the old priest said, standing and looking Fila in the eyes. You're a fool if you believe otherwise.
Fila bristled at the sudden coolness and lack of respect in his voice. She almost berated him for talking to the queen in such a manner. But she held back, because this was little to do with her being queen, and nothing at all to do with royal duties. This was all about her.
With me, Per Ostvik, she said. Shom will follow on behind. Oh, and call me a fool again, and she'll help you on your way.
On his way to what, she did not say, but the threat was enough to get the old priest moving. They walked together through the wide base of Batika Tower, heading down narrow stairways and toward the subterranean levels. If Per Ostvik felt surprised that Fila knew the layout of the vast tower so well, he did not betray it. They passed several priests on the way, all of whom stood to one side and dipped their heads to the queen. Soon they approached their destination, and Fila saw three other members of the Silent waiting close by as instructed. She had never seen them so tense. Even Shom radiated concern. It was many years since any of the Silent had been inside the Temple of Four, and Fila was more than aware of the antagonism between them and the phage. There were stories of conflict between the two groups long, long ago, but very little was known of either. Fila herself knew more of the Silent than anyone alive, and as for the Eldritch Phage, she wasn't even sure they were real anymore. Old stories told of ancient battles, but sightings nowadays were few and far between, and more often than not reported by madmen, drunks, or those ruined by Spiza. Shom's nervous readiness now told Fila more of the phage than any number of old myths and legends.
The Apex will not take kindly to your soldiers invading the Temple of Four, Ostvik said.
Your tone is becoming worrisome, Fila said. I am your queen, Per Ostvik, and don't forget.
Majesty, he said, dipping his head slightly as they arrived at a door he must have known only too well. Old and heavy, inlaid with sea glass and ornate metal banding, he would have passed through this opening many times.
Besides, it's not an invasion. Shom and the Silent are here for my protection, and to carry out my bidding.
Of course.
The old high priest said.
Of course. Now, open the door.
He opened the door, gesturing for the queen to enter before him. She did, with Shom flowing behind like her shadow. Per Ostvik followed. Per Garin and Per Ristolo were already waiting inside. They were on the far side of the room, a wonderful place of reflections and colored light. A sea-glass spiral was inlaid in the floor between them, and both looked nervous. They stood close together, and Fila had the impression that she'd caught them mid-conversation.
Majesty, they said, bowing their heads.
Fila smiled and nodded. Behind her, Per Ostvik closed the door, and she heard the heavy clunk of the lock engaging. Instinct took Shom into a shadowed area to the left, where colored light from the glass and mirrors barely reached her. Fila saw the big silence image reflected several times around the room. It gave her comfort. She glanced down at the pattern in the floor, trying to hide her excitement and nervousness.
I've never been so close, she thought, even though she wasn't sure that was entirely true. She had attempted the journey to the deep places beneath the Temple of Four from Palace Hill, but they had been secretive adventures, ill-judged and fated to fail. Her experiences had frightened her, and although she had never actually decided to not try again, in reality she'd been biding her time for this moment. This moment when she would journey down to those places she sought along the proper routes. The priests glanced nervously at one another. Per Ristolo, the big man, looked older than he ever had before. Per Garin's silver hair was in disarray,
and Fila suspected that the silent soldier sent to fetch her had woken her. Good. She wanted them frightened and unsettled. What she had to say would certainly disturb them more, and Fila needed complete control of the situation if this was to work. Her heart beat fast. Is this what it was like for Mother? She wondered. She would never know. But she did know that, untouched by Spiza, she was far more in control than her mother had ever been. In control, prepared, and aware of what unhindered magic had done to Queen Lysandra. That was why she had 3 High Order priests here, right from the beginning.
You know what I want, she said.
Her voice sounded strange in the small room, dead and flat, as if the place had no echo or was far larger than it seemed. Maybe the mirrors and glass carried her voice away. Some believed there was another world beyond the mirrors, exactly like their own, only reversed. Fila knew that there were more worlds within this world, and one of them was below her feet.
It's impossible,
Per Ristolo said.
Impossible? She asked.
Dangerous. Your mother.
My mother was murdered.
The priest's eyes went wide. Per Garen gasped in shock, her hand going to her throat. Per Ristolo staggered a little.
Murdered?
Per Ostvik asked.
By you, Fila said. By all of you.
No. No, Majesty, we served your mother well, and with all our hearts, and anything she asked, we—
Even if it endangered her?
No one replied to that.
Even if you knew that what she asked would poison her, deflate her, and lead to her eventual death?
She was being prepared, Per Ostvik said, sad now rather than defiant. She demanded too much of us too quickly, and we did our best to keep the process as slow as possible. It takes years for a high priest to get to a stage where he or she is even ready to be taken down, let alone introduced to the echoes of the magic of the 4 that persist in the deep places of the world. Many years, and sometimes a priest is never deemed ready. We can do all that's necessary from the outside. Instruction, education, mental and physical preparations and fitness, contemplation and meditation. But we cannot change how a person is on the inside. Fear hides deep, like a fish that can never be caught. Doubt sets a seed of rot.
And what was my mother's fault? She asked.
Impatience, Per Ristolo said.
And she was an addict, Per Ostvik said. Her addiction to Spiza was her great weakness.
I am not an addict, Fila said.
But impatient, Per Ostvik replied. Majesty, this is not your place. This is not your time. The blood of the 4 runs in your veins, and that is precisely the reason you cannot be—
Precisely the reason why I will be taken down, Fila shouted. Their blood is my blood, and their magic is my magic. You'll show me everything. This one time, here and now, you'll take me down and reveal to me what you priests have been doing, seeing, finding, hiding, down there for generations. Once I know it all, then you will prepare me as you prepare one another. I am not impatient. I am cautious. Careful. You will be too. But caution and speed are not always opposed, and we will do this quickly. I'm open and ready for the magic. And I will have it.
You ask the impossible, Per Ostvik said. It'll be toxic to you, just as it was to your mother.
I am not my mother, Fila said, her rage blooming. She had expected resistance, but also reverence. Yet down here, out of sight of everyone, these high-order priests were looking at her like one of their novices.
Majesty, it's far too dangerous, Per Ristolo said. Magic is unpredictable.
I see it in you, Per Ristolo, Fila said. I smell it. I can almost taste it. And you can't deny that.
I cannot deny that I have been studying and honoring magic for more decades than you and your mother have been alive, he said. And still, it haunts and hurts me.
It also keeps you alive.
Peristolo said nothing.
I do not ask this lightly. I need the magic and the power it affords, she said.
Her voice softened, though her determination did not, and she managed to hide her anger for a time.
Quandus suffers from weakness and aimlessness, and with this magic I will ease that suffering. My reasons are sound. You cannot deny it, she said, as if daring them to do exactly that. My mother, I can't pretend to know why she sought magic so quickly and rashly, but her reasons were not my own. My reasons are righteous, and you all need to understand that. I accept this is my risk, but it's one that is not up for debate. Our nation is rotting from the inside out, and we must do what we can to fix that, so you must take me there. I don't know the way, nor the ways, but you do. Take me now, let me see and feel, and then when we resurface, you will prepare me for regular visits.
No, Per Ostvik said. Fila glared at the three priests. Though frightened before her, they also presented a unified front. Their old eyes were sad but strong, their bodies infirm but set in their ways. Her pleas and demands had not worked. She was disappointed for sure, but she had also expected this. She had prepared.
Shom, she said.
Shom flowed from behind her, a swirl of clothing, a shift of air, and her sword whispered as it swung down into Per Ostvik's head. The silent stepped back after the rapid assault, and the priests on either side of the old soldier staggered aside in shock. The assassin's weapon had cleaved Per Ostvik's head in two, the wound traveling down into his torso to just above his chest. Blood and clear fluid flowed across his expression of surprise. He slumped and fell forward, spilling a mess of blood and brains from his ruptured skull. They splashed, then began flowing around the spiral pattern in the floor, following the depressions and lines drawn, carved, and inlaid by skilled craftsmen many generations ago. Fila's heart quickened at the sight, a modicum of shock, but mostly excitement. She could never go back from this, because it was out in the open, before witnesses she needed to survive this day, and the next if she was going to accomplish all she wanted to do. She would not turn away from what she had done here today. Per Ostvik gave one final shudder, and then he was dead. But his blood still flowed, and where it touched, it had influence on their world. With a whisper, the floor beneath Fila's feet began to drop away. She backed up, as did the other two priests, as a set of wide spiral steps sunk down around a central stone column. Per Ostvik's body slipped down into the recess and slid a few steps into the darkness, coming to a stop half out of sight around the first tight bend.
The way down, Fila breathed.
You can't, Per Ristolo whispered.
I think I just showed you I can.
Or what? Per Garin asked. You think that scares us? You think death is a fear for us?
Oh, not at all, Fila said. I would never underestimate you. That's why I've made it my business to know things, such as Per Ostvik has two nieces and a nephew. One nephew and one niece live on Heartshorn Hill. They're both teachers. The nephew has a wife and four children. The niece also has a wife, and they adopted three orphans from the northern lands following the flooding 3 years ago. They dote upon them. The other niece is a corporal in the city guard. Ostvik has two elderly brothers, both retired, both living by the coast with their spouses. There are nine cousins with their own families. Beyond that, the blood relations become more distant, but still traceable. His brothers are both rich and somewhat antagonistic toward the crown. But that's not why they will be killed. They'll be killed because they are related by blood to Per Ostvik, and he has displeased me. She glanced at Shom. Send someone to make it happen. Shom nodded and left the room.